You're listening to Radio Hangar, where the aviation conversation never stops. This is The Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. And folks, today we're going back to one of the most extraordinary chapters in aviation history. A story about air power, yes, but not the kind that drops bombs. This is a story about the kind that drops candy bars. And if that doesn't grab you right away, just wait, because this one starts with a blockade, a city on the edge of starvation, and a young pilot who changed the world with a couple sticks of chewing gum and a handkerchief. Pull up a chair. We're talking about the Berlin Airlift. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's 1948. The war has been over for 3 years, but Europe is still a mess. Germany is carved into four occupation zones. The Americans, British, and French hold the western sectors, the Soviets hold the east, and right smack, in the middle of the Soviet zone, sits Berlin, itself split four ways. West Berlin is an island, a free island surrounded by Soviet-controlled territory. Now, Stalin doesn't like the idea of a thriving democratic outpost sitting inside his sphere of influence. So on June 24, 1948, the Soviets shut it all down. Rail lines, roads, canal traffic. Every ground route into West Berlin sealed off. 2.5 million people cut off from food, fuel, medicine, everything. The message was simple: get out or watch the city starve. And here's the thing most people forget. The Western Allies had drawn down hard after the war. We didn't have the military muscle to force a ground corridor without risking another shooting war. And nobody wanted World War III, just 3 years after the last one ended. But there were the air corridors, three narrow lanes of airspace, each 20 miles wide, that had been agreed upon in writing. One from the American zone, one from the British zone, one from the French zone. The Soviets couldn't close those without tearing up a formal agreement. So the Allies looked at those three little highways in the sky and said, "All right, we'll feed a city by air." Now here's where it gets interesting. Because when the military planners first did the math, it looked impossible. West Berlin needed about 4,500 tons of supplies every single day just to survive. Food. Coal, that was the big one. Coal, Berlin runs cold in the winter, and you need coal to keep people alive. 4,500 tons a day by air. Nobody had ever done anything remotely like that. The workhorse of the operation was the Douglas C-54 Skymaster. Beautiful airplane, four engines, reliable as a hammer, and she could haul about 10 tons of cargo. The C-47, the old Goonie bird from the war. She was there at the start too, but she could only carry about 3.5 tons. They phased her out pretty quick once the C-54s started arriving in numbers. The British threw in everything they had. Avro York's Handley, Page Hastings, even some short Sunderland flying boats that landed on the Havel River to deliver salt. And they used salt because salt corrodes metal, and they didn't want to chew up the insides of their land-based transports. So the flying boats hauled the salt. You can't make this stuff up. The operation had a name. The Americans called it Operation Vittles. The British called theirs Operation Plainfare, and it started rough. Real rough. In the early days, they were moving maybe 1,000 tons a day. Nowhere near enough. The approaches into Tempelhof were tight. You had apartment buildings on the approach path so close you could see people in their windows as you came in. Pilots talked about dodging chimney pots and the weather. Berlin weather in the fall and winter of 48 was brutal. Low ceilings, fog, rain, icing conditions. The kind of weather that makes instrument flying a white-knuckle affair even when you're not threading through a city with buildings on both sides of the approach. General William Tunner took command of the operation in late July. And Tunner was a logistics genius. He'd run the hump operation during the war, flying supplies over the Himalayas to China. He knew how to move tonnage by air. And the first thing he did was impose order on what had been controlled chaos. Here's how it worked under Tunner. The aircraft were stacked in a constant stream, one plane every 3 minutes landing at Tempelhof, then Gadow, then Tegel. Once the French built that airfield, if you missed your approach, you did not go around for another try. You flew back to your base with your cargo and got back in line. There was no second chance. The whole system depended on precision and flow. One missed approach, one go around, and you'd back up the whole stream for hours. The crews called it the conveyor belt, and it ran around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 15 months. Think about what that took, not just airplanes and fuel, but people. Ground crews who could unload a C-54 in under 30 minutes. Mechanics keeping those Pratt and Whitney R-2000 engines turning in freezing conditions with limited hangar space. Air traffic controllers managing a flow of aircraft that the system was never designed to handle. Pilots flying 3 round trips a day in weather that would keep most of us on the ground today, and the toll was real. 78 people died during the Berlin airlift. Pilots, crew members, ground personnel, crashes on approach, mechanical failures. Mid-air collisions in that soup. These were young men, many of them barely into their 20s, flying worn-out transport planes into one of the most demanding aviation environments ever created. And they did it because the alternative was abandoning 2.5 million people to a dictator. Now the candy bombers. This is where the story goes from remarkable to unforgettable, and it starts with one guy. First Lieutenant Gail Halverson from Garland, Utah, a C-54 pilot, 27 years old, flying coal runs into Tempelhof. One day, on his off time, Halverson grabbed his hand-cranked movie camera and went out to the fence at the end of the runway at Tempelhof. There was always a crowd of kids there, watching the planes come in. German kids, kids who'd grown up in rubble, kids who were living on whatever the airlift could deliver. Halverson started talking to them through the fence. And what struck him, what really got to him, was that these kids didn't beg. He said later that not one of those kids asked him for anything. They just told him how grateful they were, that the planes kept coming, that as long as they could hear those engines overhead, they knew they hadn't been forgotten. Halverson reached into his pocket. He had two sticks of Wrigley's Double Mint Gum. That's all. Two sticks. He broke them in half and passed the pieces through the fence, and the kids who didn't get any held the wrappers to their noses and just breathed in the scent. That image broke Halverson's heart. Right there at that fence. He told the kids he'd come back the next day and drop candy from his airplane. They asked him how they'd know which plane was his. He said, "I'll wiggle my wings." So the next day, Halverson and his crew made little parachutes out of handkerchiefs and tied candy bars and gum to them, and on approach into Tempelhof, he wiggled the wings of his C-54 and dropped those tiny parachutes out the flare chute. He didn't ask permission, he didn't file a request, he just did it. And the next day, he did it again, and again, and the crowd of kids at the fence got bigger and bigger. Letters started arriving at Tempelhof addressed to Uncle Wiggly Wings and the chocolate flyer. Kids drew maps of their neighborhoods with X marks where they wanted the candy dropped. Now Halverson knew he was operating outside the rules. He'd told his crew chief and his co-pilot, but he hadn't told his commanding officer, and this thing was growing. It couldn't stay a secret forever. It didn't. A newspaper reporter spotted the tiny parachutes and ran the story, and it landed on General Tunner's desk. Here's where Gail Halverson figured his flying career was over. He was summoned to see the general, and he walked in expecting to get chewed out, grounded, maybe worse. But Tunner was smarter than that. Tunner looked at what Halvorsen was doing and saw something the supply charts couldn't measure. He saw morale. He saw the people of Berlin looking up at those planes not just as a lifeline, but as a gesture of genuine human kindness. He saw a propaganda victory that no policy paper could ever deliver. Tunner didn't shut it down, he expanded it. He turned it into Operation Little Vittles. Within weeks, candy and gum was pouring in from all over America. School kids collected candy, factories donated it. Women's groups sewed thousands of miniature parachutes, the whole country got behind it, and pilots all across the airlift started making their own drops. Over the course of the airlift, Operation Little Vittles dropped over 21 tons of candy and gum to the children of Berlin, 21 tons from handkerchiefs and two sticks of Double Mint gum. Let me give you the numbers on the airlift itself, because they're staggering. Over the 15 months of the operation, Allied aircraft made more than 277,000 flights into Berlin. They delivered over 2.3 million tons of cargo. At the peak in the spring of 1949, they were landing a plane every 62 seconds at Tempelhof. They actually exceeded the daily tonnage that had been coming in by rail and road before the blockade. They beat the trains. By air. On April 15, 1949, and that happens to be 77 years ago today, the Allies launched the Easter Parade, an all-out maximum effort. In 24 hours, they delivered nearly 13,000 tons of cargo in over 1,400 flights. 1,400 flights in one day. It was a statement. It told the Soviets that the airlift could not be starved out, could not be waited out, could not be beaten. The Soviets got the message. On May 12, 1949, they lifted the blockade. The roads and rails opened again, but the airlift kept flying until September 30th, building up a reserve, making sure Berlin would never be that vulnerable again. Now, what happened to Gail Halverson? He became one of the most beloved Americans in German history. The Germans call him Der Rosinenbomber, the Raisin Bomber. He went back to Berlin many times over the decades. He was there for the 50th anniversary, the 60th children. He dropped candy to as kids brought their grandchildren to meet him. Halverson lived to be 101 years old. He passed away in February of 2022 at his home in Provo, Utah. A full life, a life that proved something that every pilot knows in their bones but doesn't always get to see so clearly. That an airplane is just a machine. It's what you do with it that matters. You know what gets me about this story? It's not the tonnage numbers, it's not the logistics, although those are miraculous in their own right. It's the moment at the fence. A young pilot with two sticks of gum looking at kids who had nothing and deciding on the spot that he was going to do something about it. No committee. No approval chain. Just a man with an airplane and a conscience. That's aviation at its finest. not the speed records or the altitude records or the technology. It's the human being in the left seat who looks down and decides to make a difference. And those C-54s, those big, reliable, unglamorous Skymasters, they never get the glory that the fighters and bombers do. You don't see too many C-54s at air shows, but those airplanes saved a city. They kept freedom alive in a place where it was about to be snuffed out. If that's not worthy of the same reverence we give a P-51 Mustang or a B-17, I don't know what is. There's a C-54 on display at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. Spirit of Freedom, she's called. And there's one at the Allied Museum in Berlin, parked right near the old Tempelhof Airport. If you ever find yourself in either place, go stand in front of that airplane for a minute. Think about what she carried, not just coal and flour. Hope, that's what those planes hauled into Berlin, hope. Well, folks, that's our story for today. Sources for this one include the Air Force Historical Studies Office, the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library, the National Museum of the United States Air Force, the Berlin Airlift Historical Foundation, and Gail Halverson's own memoir. As always, this is an AI-generated broadcast here on Radio Hangar, created by real pilots who care about keeping these stories alive. Want to hear more or dig into the sources? Visit us at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. 77 years ago today, those crews flew the Easter Parade and showed the world what airplanes and determination could do. We owe it to them to remember. So next time you're up there and the controller clears you for the approach and everything is smooth and routine, just remember, there was a time when that approach meant everything, when the sound of those engines was the sound of freedom itself. Fly safe, friends. Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.